Our speaker this morning, Dr. Adam Francisco, is Associate Professor of History and Political Thought at Concordia University, Irvine, California. Earned his MA in Theology 2001 from Concordia University, Irvine. His MSD and his PhD from the University of Oxford, where he studied Arabic and Islamic theology at the Center of Islamic Studies, and he wrote Martin Luther and Islam, published by Brill, very expensive. Okay. I'm still waiting for a copy of that, free. He served as an Alban Sultan Fellow at the University of London's Warburg Institute, Assistant Professor of History at Concordia Bronxville, and Visiting Professor of Historical Theology at Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana. Blah, blah, blah. Dr. Adam Francisco is my deer hunting partner. All the deer he's ever shot have been on my family farm in Iowa. More than one, less than 100. All Dr. Francisco knows about deer hunting, he learned from me. That includes deer camp, but thankfully we have no time for details. Dr. Francisco and I began our teaching duties at CTS here at the same time, and while the student population did not suffer, other populations on campus, notably the goose population, did suffer. Again, no time for details. I consider Dr. Francisco a good friend and have had the privilege of baptizing one of his children. And when it comes to his topic for us today, Islam's future in America, replacing a Christian culture, he is the only one I would go out of my way to hear talk. Please welcome Dr. Adam Francisco. Thank you.
Oh, yeah. I asked him not to mention anything that would include lawbreaking, and thankfully he didn't do that, or at least a verifiable instance of lawbreaking. Good morning, and thank you for that nice welcome. This morning's topic, or my topic, is Islam's future in America, replacing a Christian culture, and maybe we should put a question mark at the end of that. I don't have PowerPoint. I'm terrible at PowerPoint. I tried to use it not too long ago on an iPad, or Keynote, I think it's called, but my kids have taken over my iPad, and so I keep on would get notifications from Care Bears games and things as I'm doing talks, so I've just given up completely. So here we go. Muslims have been present in the United States for over two centuries. The first were from Africa, brought over in the slave trade. We don't know how many there were, nor do we know much of their history. It is still being pieced together from the few extant records they left behind. We do know, and this should come as no surprise, that their influence on American culture was basically negligible. In fact, it seems that the folk Islam that was brought over failed to survive the first generation. The few Muslims there were left little to no mark in the historical record. That changed in the late 19th century when the first Muslim missionary entered the United States. His name was Muhammad Alexander Russell Webb. His story is interesting, for he was born in Hudson, New York, raised in a Presbyterian household, moved to Missouri for work as a journalist, where he became a materialist, toyed with spiritualism and the occult, and eventually joined the Pioneer Theosophical Society of St. Louis. In a condensed form, he began a Calvinist and ended up a Muslim. Go figure. In 1887, he was appointed to serve as the American consul to the Philippines. Between his arrival in Manila in 1888 and his resignation in 1892, he had embraced Islam, established ties with Muslims in India, and received a commission from them to begin a mission to America. It was called the American Islamic Propaganda. Already by 1893, Webb had established a publishing company, opened a lecture hall, and created an organization called the American Muslim Brotherhood in New York City, with the goal of disseminating information on Islam and creating the institutions necessary for the endeavors of future missionaries. The same year, he was invited to address the World Parliament of Religions as the only representative of Islam, where he told those gathered, "I have not returned to the United States to make you all Muslims in spite of yourselves, but I have faith in the American intellect, in the American intelligence, and in the American love of fair play, and I will defy any intelligent man to understand Islam and not love it." As it turned out, Americans in the late 19th century didn't love Islam, and they defied Webb. By 1897, his mission was obsolete. Shortly thereafter, he moved to New Jersey and lived there until his death in 1916. Despite Webb's failure, Islam still found a way to America in the late 19th century. It came with thousands of immigrants that managed to circumvent the restrictions of the Immigration Act of 1891. They came from a variety of places. By the 1920s, it is estimated that around 60,000 had settled in a number of cities throughout the United States. Most of them kept their religion private and sometimes even lied about it. But others were apparently emboldened to advance Islam. The first American journal that reported on Muslim affairs recounted some of the activities of these missionaries. For example, one author recounted how an Indian Muslim named M.M. Sadiq experienced a good bit of success in winning converts amongst African Americans in Chicago, Detroit, Indianapolis, St. Louis, and other cities in just 3 years. He did this by holding what are described as mosque meetings, where the virtues of Islam were exalted and Christianity was severely criticized. Another missionary named M.B. Bengali, who worked mostly amidst whites, is described as declaring the plan of Islam to, quote, conquer America to a company of Muslims in 1920. It is around this time that Americans started paying attention to Islam. The New York Times frequently reported on Webb, describing him as the American Mohammedan whom the wealthy Muslims of India and the East have sent to introduce the faith of Islam, the religion of the sword, as some have called it, among the civilized Christians of the West. Towards the end of his short-lived mission, he was even ridiculed. The Syracuse Sunday Herald reported on the fanatical zeal in which Muslims were attempting to bring Islam to Americans, and the Chicago Tribune described the work of Webb and others like him as a new fad for those curiously constructed beings who are always chasing after new and strange doctrines. It was evangelical Christians that took Islam the most serious. For them, Islam was Christianity's only serious rival for the religious conquest of the world, and Christians' most aggressive evangelistic competitors on the world stage. They thus began to develop plans for the direct evangelization of Muslims where they might live. Arabic and Islamic studies was offered at an American seminary for the first time, beginning with the professorship of Duncan Black MacDonald in Hartford, Connecticut. Eventually, an institute for the study of Islam and Christian-Muslim relations was established in his name. In 1911, the American apostle to Islam, Samuel Zwemer, established an academic journal primarily for missionaries entitled The Muslim World. Both of these, the Duncan MacDonald Center and the journal The Muslim World, are now dominated by Muslims these days. Were originally designed as a journal for missionaries, Christian missionaries, to study and to read, to understand Islam. But now the entire faculty of the MacDonald Center is 100% Muslim. The journal has an editor who's a Muslim who has a kind of an interesting past, kicked out of Belgium for translating a fatwa saying it's okay to behead Christians in Muslim lands. But now he's, even though he was forbidden from entering the U.S. till about 2010, because of this past, Hillary Clinton overturned the restrictions. Nevertheless, the interest of evangelicals in Islam and missions to Muslims, on that positive note, the interest of evangelicals in Islam and missions to Muslims continued and in some ways increased in the wake of World War I. So too did the interest of Muslims in settling in and influencing America. The most comprehensive study of Islam's history in America to date suggests that this was a pivotal stage in which American Muslims' institutions and community building efforts took root. The activity of the Sudanese immigrant Sati Majid provides a useful example of such endeavors. Sati, who had appointed himself the Sheikh of Islam in America, arrived in 1904 and stayed until 1929. Estimating the national population of Muslims to be around 100,000, 20,000 which he claimed were converts, but noting that there wasn't a single mosque, Muslim charity, or any national Muslim organization, he began to establish institutions designed to serve American Muslims. In Detroit, he helped begin the Muslim version of the Red Cross, the Red Crescent, formed an organization called the Islamic Union, acquired plots for Muslim burials at Roselawn Cemetery, and claim to have even established the first mosque in America, though there's no evidence for it. Similar projects were pursued in other cities. Beyond this, he also worked to promote Islam in the public sphere by writing editorials for the New York Times. They never published them, and so, perhaps in the first instance of struggling to silence opposition to Islam through litigation, he attempted to sue the paper for not publishing his articles as well as what he described as its anti-Islamic propaganda. We'd call it Islamophobia today. At the same time that Sati Majid was working to support and promote a fairly orthodox form of Islam in the United States, heterodox, or by normal Sunni standards, heretical Muslim groups like the Moorish Science Temple, Nation of Islam, and the Ahmadi movement were taking root. And they began to thrive, particularly amidst African Americans. The first verifiable mosques serving Orthodox Muslims were also established at this time in a variety of cities and towns like Ross, North Dakota, and Cedar Rapids, Iowa. This is the basic story of Islam in America before World War II. What develops afterwards actually starts in the Middle East. After World War I, the character of the Muslim world was radically altered. The Ottoman Empire came to an end, the Caliphate was abolished, and European powers, primarily the British and the French, began their supervision of the region. States were created, governments established, and economies reformed. While many benefited and continue to benefit from it, to Islamic thinkers, Islamic civilization had finally lost its soul. After centuries of decline under the Ottomans, it was now dead, and a new secular order had emerged. Nowhere was this view more pronounced than in the rhetoric of Hassan al-Banna and his newly established Muslim Brotherhood. The Brotherhood began in 1928. Its early activities centered on preaching and social welfare, but it soon turned to violence. And since it was seen as the only really legitimate Islamic group that resisted the expansion and dominance of secular influences within Muslim societies, it grew quickly. By 1948, it had 500,000 members, and branches could be found throughout Egypt. It did experience some setbacks, though. For example, the Egyptian government, a monarchy at this point, arrested much of its leadership, and al-Banna was assassinated in 1949. But the Brotherhood would receive renewed vigor a year or two later when a man named Said Qutb returned from a two-year visit to America and began writing some of the most influential texts informing what is often described as Islamism. Islamism is Islam viewed as an all-encompassing worldview or ideology. Governance, politics, law, morality, and every other aspect of life is ordered by the Quran and Islamic tradition. For every real or perceived problem, Islamists claim, al-Islam huwa al-hal, or Islam is the solution. Qutb taught that the whole world, I've always wanted to do some Arabic up here at Concordia Theological Seminary on stage. Finally got my opportunity. Qutb taught that the whole world suffered from the same basic condition. It was mired in jahiliya, or ignorance of Islam. And this included the Muslim world in the mid-20th century as much as the Western world. Muslims thus had a tremendous burden to advance the cause of Islam wherever the opportunity presented itself. In his detailed history of Islam in America, Cambiz Ghania Basiri observes that an increasing number of Muslims with an Islamist ideology began to migrate to the United States on student visas shortly after the end of World War II, where they, as he put it, took advantage of the freedoms to organize around their varying ideologies. At the same time that these Islamists began making their way into and influencing American Muslims and their organizations, the latter began to work towards the goal of having Islam recognized as an American religion. An opportunity presented itself in the late 1940s and 50s with the intentional development of American civil religion before and during the presidency of Dwight D. Eisenhower. In 1948, the National Education Association began promoting the advancement of a universal vision of moral and spiritual values that were shared by the members of all religious faiths. So in 1952, the newly established Federation of Islamic Associations began its effort to define Islam as yet another of the monotheistic religions upon which American values were founded. They were largely successful. By 1957, their efforts led to the building of the Islamic Center of Washington, D.C., where at its inauguration, President Eisenhower acknowledged Islam's place in the American religious landscape, as he put it, as many from the Muslim lands, students, businessmen, and representatives of states are enjoying the benefits of experiencing among the people of the United States. Just how many Muslims there were in America in the mid-20th century is uncertain. There were enough, though, that the Middle Eastern governments began to take notice. For example, in 1959, the Federation of Islamic Associations established formal ties with Egypt and Syria under the auspices of the short-lived United Arab Republic, inviting its leadership to Cairo for meetings and to donate funds for the building of an Islamic center in Detroit. 2 years later, in 1961, the Saudis got involved. It's always a bad thing. The 1960s, in general, were a productive year for the strengthening of Islam in America. The number of students sent here on scholarship from places like Iran, Pakistan, Syria, Jordan, and Indonesia was over 10,000. Less than two decades prior, there weren't even 3,000. Also, though numbers of this are unknown, at the same time, American Muslim students began to receive scholarships to study at Muslim universities. Some received more than just a university education. They also received an education in Islamism. For example, in 1964, when Denzel Washington or Malcolm X went on pilgrimage to Mecca, he was trained in Sunni Islamic ideology and provided with guarantees for scholarships to American Muslims at the University of Medina. All of this was provided by the Muslim World League, an organization founded in 1962 by Hassan al-Banna's son-in-law, Saeed Ramadan. It was designed to unite Islamist groups from around the Muslim world in the common cause of advancing Islam across the globe. Those who came under its spell and the spell of Islamism established the Muslim Student Association in 1963 on the campus of the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. This organization, which now has hundreds of chapters across North America, laid the foundation for the subsequent history of Islam in America. It saw itself as the provider of the means and methods of maintaining a Muslim way of life for earlier established mosques and American Muslim organizations. It also saw the United States as a blank slate for the realization of an authentic Islamic lifestyle in accordance with the Quran and classical traditions of Islam, whereas secularized autocratic governments in the Muslim world had begun to clamp down on Islamism, and for good reason, as many of them were increasingly turning towards violence in their struggle or jihad against the corruptions of Islam in the Muslim world. America became, in a way, a land of promise for Muslims, especially those with Islamist commitments in the 1960s. A study of the Muslim World League even expressed that despite the sorry state of affairs prevailing in the Muslim countries, they were optimistic for the future of Islam. Their source of hope was found in the Muslim minorities of America that might one day produce those sons and daughters of Islam who might change the whole course of events of the entire Muslim Ummah, or global community. At about the same time that Islamism established its base organizationally, other expressions of Islam began to appear as a wide array of Muslims began to immigrate here in droves after passage of the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1965, which abolished national origins quotas from immigration law. With this came a tremendous amount of diversity where the increasing Muslim population became a microcosm of Muslims in the old world. Sunnis, Shia, and Sufis of every confession and practice began to appear alongside some of the indigenous American Muslim organizations like the Nation of Islam. The problem, at least for the historian, is that they did not leave much of a verifiable record before the 1980s. Most, as they still do today, are assimilated Americans who practice some spiritualized or watered-down version of Islam and do so in private. And if there's such a thing as Jack Mormons, I propose we call them Jack Muslims. Those that did leave a distinct record were, of course, the Islamists, committed as they were to advancing Islam as publicly as possible. And the record is clear that they intended to increase their efforts. For example, in 1975, the Muslim Student Association published its priorities for the future of what they called Islamic work in the U.S. Along with strengthening institutions that already existed, they listed their first priority as the production and dissemination of Islamic knowledge in its purity in all fields necessary for building an Islamic civilization. Muslims affiliated with the Muslim Brotherhood, which by the 70s had become a global organization with millions of members, saw this as commensurate with their goals and began to consider how the MSA and other similar American Muslim organizations might be used to achieve their broader socio-political goals. In a document not intended for public dissemination, entitled An Explanatory Memorandum on the General Strategic Goal of the Group in America, the Brotherhood outlined a fairly comprehensive strategy that would use the MSA and over 20 other similar organizations overtly tied to, or at least friendly to, the Islamist cause that could be used to fundamentally transform America by uniting Muslims that had settled in America. Here's how the memo puts it. The Ikhwan, or the Brotherhood, must understand that their work in America is a kind of grand jihad in eliminating and destroying Western civilization from within and sabotaging its miserable house by their hands and the hands of the believers, so that it is eliminated and God's religion is made victorious over all others. Without this level of understanding, we are not up to this challenge and have not prepared ourselves for jihad yet. It is a Muslim's destiny to perform jihad and work wherever he is and wherever he lands until the final hour comes. How is this jihad to be performed? The document goes into pretty comprehensive detail, but names the presenting of Islam as a civilization alternative as the chief means. In other words, rather than some show of force or even overt political activity, the Islamist group in America, and we don't know all that were and continue to be involved, sought and seeks to pursue the advance of Islam slowly, patiently, and even peacefully, and while doing so, portraying Islam as a legitimate and rational alternative to the hedonistic, relativistic, and materialistic culture that dominates the West. They were and have been pretty good at this, too. In 1980, for example, while federal employees were being held hostage by Muslims in Tehran for over a year, Congress saw fit to recognize the 1,400-year anniversary of Muhammad's call to prophethood. The success of the revolution in Iran, and especially the Afghan jihad against the Soviet Union, had the curious effect of emboldening and increasing Islamic activism in the United States during the 80s and 90s. A good percentage of Islamic organizations like the Islamic Society of North America, located just west of Indianapolis, were established then. The Muslim city of Islamburg in rural New York was founded, and a number of mosques were constructed. The Muslim population increased at times as well, or at this time as well. Some of it was simply the result of natural biological unions between a Muslim man and his wife or wives. A good portion of it, that was a joke, a good portion of it, well over a million in fact, came from an increasing number of immigrants from every walk of life and represented every disposition in Islam. This included Islamist jihadists. Bin Laden's successor, Ayman al-Zawahiri, for example, toured Silicon Valley in the early 1990s, raising funds to support the fighters and organizations that would soon become al-Qaeda. On the East Coast, mosques in New York and New Jersey, used by the CIA in the 80s to support the Afghan jihad, were also used to recruit the jihadists who bombed the World Trade Center in 1993. Other Muslims moved in a different direction. Fazlur Rahman began explaining Islam to non-Muslims in a number of publications from his post at the University of Chicago. His perspective was conservative, yet at the same time progressive. He believed Islam, an Islam ordered by the Quran and not historical interpretations of it, could thrive in without being at odds with American culture. He was even optimistic that Muslims and Christians in America and beyond could be brought together in some way, as he puts it, by way of positive cooperation, provided that Muslims hearken more to the Quran than to the historic formulations of Islam, and what he called recent pioneering efforts continued to yield a Christian doctrine more compatible with universal monotheism and egalitarianism. In other words, if a Christian stopped confessing the Christian doctrine of God and instead confessed an Islamic view of God, Muslims and Christians might get along. Go figure. It's interesting that despite the increasing presence of Islamists in the United States, and even more so across the globe during the last two decades of the 20th century, there was much ambivalence towards Islam. There was some anti-Arab sentiment as a result of the Israeli-Palestinian issue, the most extreme example being the murder of Professor Ismail al-Faruqi and his wife Lois in Pennsylvania in 1986. The Council on American Islamic Relations was even established to defend Muslims against perceived and sometimes real discrimination. But, particularly among the political elite, Islam was not seen as posing a challenge or a threat. It was accepted and perhaps even embraced by them as a legitimate American worldview. In 1991, Siraj Wahaj, an imam of a large mosque in Brooklyn, and leader of the Muslim Alliance in North America, who has numerous ties to Islamists, was invited and opened a session of the House of Representatives with a prayer to Allah. Warith Deen Muhammad, the son of the prophet Elijah Muhammad, offered one on the Senate floor less than a year later. In 1993, the first Muslim chaplain, Abdul Rashid Muhammad, was appointed to the U.S. military. In 1996, Hillary Clinton began the tradition of celebrating the end of the month of Ramadan at the White House. And her husband established what seems like the American doctrine of Islam as a religion of peace. despite any stubborn facts that might suggest otherwise. In 1994, at a meeting of the Jordanian Parliament, President Clinton affirmed Islam as a religion that embodies values in, as he put it, harmony with the best of American ideals. Muslims pursuing violent jihad, he continued, cloak themselves in the rhetoric of religion and nationalism, but they behave in ways that contradict the very teachings of their faith. The two subsequent presidents have continued to reinforce this doctrine of disassociating Islam from violence, and under the current administration, it's gotten quite absurd. However, especially after September 11, 2001, many began to see things differently. But even before, during the 1990s, men like Daniel Pipes and Stephen Emerson were warning Americans in print and in other media about the deleterious effect and potential violent consequences of Islamism left unchecked. Now there's a whole industry dedicated to fighting it. Some of it is solid, a good bit of it is plagued by conspiracy theories and careless assertions. I won't mention names, takes a martini or four to get them out of me. But Muslims have responded to this in a variety of ways. Some perform what is called taqiyya, or dissimulation. The activity of Anwar al-Awlaki is a good example. He began as a bright young imam teaching on the moderate and peaceful disposition of Islam in places like the Pentagon. In 2004, he disappeared and ended up in Yemen, leading the branch of al-Qaeda there until he was killed in a drone strike in 2011. Or take the Clintons' preferred consultant on all matters Islamic, Abdulrahman al-Amoudi. For years, he enjoyed special access to and privilege amidst leaders in both the Democrat and Republican parties as a fundraiser. He's so good at raising funds that he started raising funds for al-Qaeda. And he's now serving a 23-year prison sentence for financing terrorism, though Hillary Clinton is trying to get his sentence communicated. This list could go on and on. Chances are, unless you're a so-called Islamophobe, maybe like me, or counterterrorism wonk, you haven't heard much about these cases. What you no doubt have heard quite a bit about is the efforts of Muslims to, as it's sometimes put, take back Islam from those who have already corrupted it. These are people like Zudi Jasser, who have fully assimilated into American culture and maintain a private, spiritualized view and practice of Islam. Some of them have even made remarkable contributions toward efforts to educate and expose the proliferation and danger of Islamist ideologies amidst a significant number of American Muslims and their organizations. The Third Jihad, featuring Zudi, is a great example of such a project. Now available on YouTube for free. The problem with some of these moderate assimilated Muslims is that their knowledge of and credentials to speak on Islam are either weak or not all that influential. That's not to say they are stupid or haven't studied at university. It's that Muslims who strive to align their beliefs, practices, and activities with traditional orthodoxy view them as misguided Muslims at best, who select passages from the Quran or Islamic tradition regardless of context or legitimacy and use it to support a novel or historically and legally marginalized view of Islam. Other more moderate Muslims force Islam into the Procrustean bed of contemporary ethical, political, and religious standards and call it Islam. They even justify it by appealing to historical precedents of ijtihad, whereby the earliest generation of Muslims struggled intellectually with the Quranic text, tradition, and their context to establish the boundaries of orthodoxy. This does hold some promise, at the very least, in pacifying Islam and legitimizing the assimilation of Muslims, but contemporary mujtahids face an uphill battle giving the closing or prescribing of such practices in the classical period of Muslim jurisprudence. They are also viewed with suspicion by observant Muslims and charged with the sin of innovation, usually accompanied by the quote from Muhammad that says, "Every innovation is an error and every error is a sin." Take the professor of Islamic studies at UVA and now George Mason University, Abdulaziz Sajidina, as an example. He's often viewed as one of the leading academic figures in the reinterpretation and pacification of Islam. He was even brought in by the State Department to help draft the Constitution of Iraq, with high hopes that the proposals he made in his book, like the peculiarly titled Islamic Roots of Democratic Pluralism, that they would establish Iraq as a model for other Muslim-majority nations to follow. Sajidina has tried to advance what he calls a Muslim theology for the 21st century, that is established within the sacred boundaries of the Islamic revelatory sources. He sees this task as essential, for among the world's religions, as he puts it, Islam provides the sole coherent worldview of any political significance that also has the potential to build a just society in which people of different religions would coexist in peace and harmony. And it alone can help to deepen the West's self-understanding in its liberal project of a public international order. How does he do this? He deconstructs the classical, exclusive, politicized theology of Islam and reconstructs in its place an Islam that has ever existed, one that champions constitutional government, tolerance, pluralism, and so on. He does this by assigning new meaning to the Quranic text. For example, according to his exegesis, jihad is not physical warfare with religious significance. It is a moral endeavor to work for peace with justice. And as far as the exclusive nature of Islam goes, he essentially sees all people who, in their own way and in accordance with their own religion, submit to God as ipso facto Islamic. Passages that encourage the killing of polytheists, Jews, and Christians are all the result of particular historical circumstances, he argues. Religious pluralism, he contends, is the universal norm and doctrine by which the Quran stands or falls. He even goes so far as suggesting that the first pluralistic democracy was promoted by Muhammad in the early Muslim polities in Mecca in the 7th century. It all sounds so postmodern, and indeed it is. And that's probably the reason he's only been well received by Western liberal academics, and also the reason why Muslims have been instructed by their authorities not to listen to him. For example, in 1999, Grand Ayatollah Sistani issued what's called a hukum, trying to silence him when he gave lectures in Iraq. What seems to be the wave of the future in Muslim thought on their role in American and the West, their role in America and the West in general, is the perspective advanced by Tariq Ramadan, the so-called Martin Luther of Islam. He appeals both to Islamists and moderate Muslims, for he is conservative and makes his home in the West, teaching in Europe, and since Hillary Clinton lifted the ban on him despite his donations to Hamas, America. The majority of his work grapples with what it means to be Muslim in societies that aren't. And this is a huge question. For historically and legally, Muslims are required by the Sharia, or Islamic law, to reside in what is deemed Darul Islam, or the abode of Islam. For only in the abode of Islam, where Muslims dominate the population, and Islamic law informs the institutions and preserves the mores of society, can Muslims properly submit to Allah. Islamic law has allowed for some exceptions. Muslims can engage in commerce, engage in diplomacy, and of course fight in jihad outside the abode of Islam, but only temporarily. After all, that territory is deemed in the Islamic tradition the domain of war, or Darul Harb. It is the territory into which the abode of Islam is to expand in, what Muhammad described as a perpetual jihad that should take place until the Day of Judgment. In Ramadan's book, Western Muslims and the Future of Islam, he argues that Muslims need to rethink this classical bifurcation of the world into essentially two warring camps. For as he put it, there is no real Darul Islam or properly constituted Islamic state that exists. He didn't follow his Muslim Brotherhood ancestors, his grandfather is Hassan al-Banna, in calling the whole world to the domain of Jahiliya, but rather refers to the West as well as the heartlands of Islam as Darul Shahada, the domain of testimony, wherein Muslims are called, whether they are in America or Egypt, to bear witness and promote the will of Allah and vision of Muhammad. In other words, Islam is again in a formative period, and Muslims are called to help, if not lead the charge in shaping it, wherever they might be. Muslims concerned with confessing and promoting Orthodox Islam do not see this as something that can or should be done willy-nilly, though. Rather, it is to be done in accordance with what Muslims across the world almost universally subscribe to as God's clear and perfectly preserved revelation, the Quran, alongside, in one way or another, the traditions passed down concerning Muhammad in the first Muslim polities. If you came here looking for an answer to the question that I'm always asked, what should we do with Islam, my answer to pastors and teachers in the church is simply put the Quran in your reading list. That's probably a no-brainer. But let me finish by asking the question implied in the title, what the future of Islam in America might look like. Well, like Muhammad, I'm no prophet. That's an old joke. I was wondering if it would work this time. It did. Good. Like Muhammad, I'm no prophet, but here's what seems to be the trend, of the past that have continuity to the present and show little sign of disappearing. First, there are currently about 5 million Muslims in America, give or take a million or two, maybe 2,000 mosques. We still don't have good data on any of this, but expect that number to rise. Muslims typically have larger families than your average American and certainly the average European. Second, expect a great bit of diversity amidst Muslims. There will be 12 or 7 or 5 or in every other sort of Shia Muslim, alongside Sunnis who are progressivists, secularists, Islamists, and even jihadists. Always has been and always will be. However, the institutions representing American Muslims in public discourse on the character of Islam in America will be predominantly Islamist of one sort or another. These Islamist organizations, however, have learned to contextualize their speech. They say one thing but mean another. For example, Islam means peace, it's been said, and in a way, though not literally, it kind of does, but it's a peace defined by Islam and one that isn't realized until you submit entirely to Allah. Third, there will be and already is a contest amidst American Muslims for the soul and posture of Islam. Moderates and progressives are already battling with conservatives. This is mostly an internal debate. Though it's been suggested, non-Muslims should seize any opportunity to promote a moderate Islam. In fact, the Congress has passed a resolution, a concurrent resolution, in adopting the agenda that will always promote moderate Islam. I'm with Mark Stein on this one and on several other issues. Several years ago, he wrote a piece in National Review that argued promoting moderate Islam was a quick fix to the challenges posed by so-called radical Islam. But in the end, it didn't work, as it's virtually impossible to get around the injunctions to violence in the Quran. And he ended the essay by saying that the only real solution to the problems associated with Islam in Western society was the oldest solution, and evangelizing Christianity. Lastly, it probably needs no elaboration. Expect more of the violence happening across the globe to find its way here. It already has. What to do with it, though, apart from getting all Jack Bowery, is still, or maybe Chris Kyle-y, is still the quintessential question. Muslims have the right to practice their religion, but it's in practicing it completely that leads to all the problems associated with it. And this is perhaps the reason why an Icelandic Lutheran hymnal in the 17th century refers to it as the terror of the world. Let me conclude with one more word on Islam in America and whether or not it will ever replace our quasi-Christian culture or so-called Christian culture. Islam is slowly but increasingly becoming a part of mainstream American culture. You see this especially in this Common Word movement that's been around for just 6 years, but it seems like everybody, including John Kerry and Tony Blair and every Muslim personality and lots of prominent Christian theologians like Rick Warren, are involved in it. Whether Islam gets stirred up in the melting pot or rises above it is anyone's guess at this point. What will determine the course of the future, though, whether it's with regard to Islam or Christianity or anything else, is the people and the institutions who show up for it. Thank you.